case number 13-7033, International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, a local 1200 appellant, versus Detroit Free Press, Inc., a subsidiary of Gannett Company, Inc., doing business of WUSA-TV. Mr. Paul for the appellant, Mr. Monroe for the appellate.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Under settled federal labor policy, a grievance filed during the term of a collective bargaining agreement is subject to arbitration unless it can be said with positive assurance that the arbitration clause is not susceptible of an interpretation that covers the dispute. Similarly, this presumption in favor of arbitration attaches even after a labor contract has expired, as long as it can be demonstrated that the grievance arose under that expired contract. In this case, Your Honors, both arms of this federal labor policy come into play in the instant dispute. In this case, we have two collective bargaining agreements. We have a 2008 collective bargaining agreement that ended in February of 2011, and we have a new collective bargaining agreement that became effective in February.
It actually ended in December, but there's an agreement to extend it.
That's correct. Right.
But was the agreement only extended?
Until February of 11.
I mean, because there was an effort to extend it beyond there, but management didn't go along with
that. That's right. And the new agreement became effective on February 9th, 2012. What happened in this case, as the court knows, is that the most senior maintenance technician in the bargaining unit, the most senior of six, was given a notice on January 30th that she was being laid off. The notice specifically said that she was being laid off under the IBEW collective bargaining agreement and made several references to the collective bargaining agreement. A few minutes before she received that notice, the union's chief steward was summoned to a meeting with the supervisor of the technicians, who informed the steward that this was about to happen and indicated that the station was relying on the provisions of the expired collective bargaining agreement, and in fact pointed to the open collective bargaining agreement that was on the supervisor's desk at the time as pointing to that as a gesture of the source of its action. In this case, both collective bargaining agreements, whether it's the 2008 agreement or the 2012 agreement, insofar as this case is concerned, have identical provisions. Both required, before anyone can be laid off, the employer of the station had to come to the union to bargain. Both required that before any full-time employee could be laid off, such as Ms. Peterson, it had to lay off all part-time employees. Both required that in the event of a layoff, employees would be laid off in the inverse order of seniority, in other words, starting with the least senior of the employees. And both agreements require that in the event of any layoff, the employee would receive 2 weeks, quote, advance notice.
But there's more to it than that, right? You're omitting an important part of the description of seniority rights, right?
What you're referring to is an exception. In a separate section of the collective bargaining agreement, the contract provides that under limited circumstances, the employer can lay off a senior employee if it can demonstrate that the junior employee's layoff would have adverse consequences on the station's operations. To frame it in this case,
is your view that the seniority rights have somehow vested here?
They've accrued, Your Honor. We do believe they've accrued. In the Litton case, which is the source of all the discussion about this, in that case, the seniority provision was, as the Supreme Court declared, only a residual benefit. The contract provided that if everything else...
Why doesn't the management protection that you refer to, why doesn't that undercut your argument that the seniority rights here have vested in? Why doesn't that make this exactly like Litton?
Because in the Litton case, the seniority only came in play if everything else was equal. Aptitude, ability would have to be equal, and only then would the employer look to the employee's seniority. Here it's just the opposite. The contract provides that seniority is is the starting point, and we say the ending point, unless, of course...
Do you have any cases in which we've found that seniority rights vest or accrue?
No, Your Honor. This circuit has not addressed that issue. That is correct. But the seniority issue...
You were about to say that there was a two-week provision that required notice in both contracts.
Yes.
But you agree, don't you, that she was terminated on January 30th?
We agree that she received a notice on January 30th. We agree that the notice specifically referenced the collective bargaining agreement. The letter that she received provided that she would be getting in the future a service letter.
A service letter just tells her, or it's for her to let others know it wasn't going because she did a bad job.
No, that's right. That's right.
But she was terminated on January 30th.
She was given a notice on January 30th. We submit that under the either contract, she could not be laid off until 2 weeks later. In any event, under the new contract...
That's not what the grievance was. If you take a look at the grievance, which is on, I don't know what page of the joint appendix, but this is her grievance signed by the union representative. It says, Karen Peterson's position was unjustly terminated on January 30th, 2012.
That's what the written grievance says, and under the new collective bargaining agreement that was effective on February 9th.
So she was terminated at a time when there was no collective bargaining agreement.
She was terminated at a time, she received a letter on a date before the new collective bargaining agreement became effective. But the new collective bargaining agreement...
The letter said... You're out of work today, and the position doesn't exist. That's terminated, isn't it?
Your Honor, it is very common, for employers on a date, even where there's a 2 week notice provision, to send the employee home and pay them. That's not an unusual conduct. In this case, though, the issue we submit is under the new contract, the 2012 contract. It had a 20 day window period to file a grievance. The contract provides that any dispute, any question, disagreement over the new contract is subject to arbitration. So whether she was terminated on January 30th or later, both of those dates fall within the 20-day window for filing a grievance. So the grievance is, we submit, a proper vehicle to contest whatever it did to Ms.
Peterson. If she's fired on January 30th, if she is fired on January 30th, how does that get her within the compass of the new contract?
Because the contract went into effect on February 9th. The grievance was filed on February 16th. There's a 20-day period to file a grievance. So
I understand, but the action with respect to which she's complaining was before the contract came into existence. There was no arbitration clause in existence at that point.
There was an arbitration clause under the new contract,
but not under the. But the problem you have is Litton, and Litton talks about the action occurring at a time you look to see whether there's an arbitration provision in existence at that time at the complaint of action. I mean, I understand with some sympathy, but you're climbing a hard hill against Litton. I was kind of shocked when I went back and read it. Those are pretty severe terms. The court talks about you may or may not have accrued seniority rights, but the question is whether the arbitration provision remains in existence at the time when the action giving rise to your claim occurred. That's what Litton says.
And Litton focuses, of course, as you say, Your Honor, on whether there's an arbitration obligation under the old agreement. Litton doesn't have anything to do.
There's an arbitration agreement at the time when the action giving rise to your complaint occurs.
Right. And under the new contract, as in the Peerless case, which is cited in Martin Will with Envelopes, which is one of the cases discussed in our brief, there the issue was whether a grievance could go back and reach an event that took place before the effective date. In that case, the court said it couldn't because the grievance process was explicitly limited to events that took place during the term. There is no such limitation in this agreement. This grievance procedure in this contract is unqualified. It covers any question, any dispute, any grievance or any problem.
Is something in the expired contract? I missed it. Your argument is something in the expired contract that overcomes Litton by suggesting that no matter what, that this contract expires and that we extend it for a bit and then don't extend it, the availability of the arbitration, we all understand, is constant. That's what this contract said, the old contract said?
The old contract says that the old contract expired and then...
But it says, this is the thrust of your argument. The contract expires, but it was written in such a way to make it clear if anything happens that someone can complain about, the availability of arbitration is constant.
That's not exactly what our argument is, Your Honor. My argument is under the new contract, the Litton analysis doesn't come into play. This is a straight whether there was a grievance, whether it covers the dispute, even arguably, whether there's a plausible interpretation that it covers the dispute. That's the end of the inquiry. Under Litton, which is a question of whether it's arbitrable under the old contract, it either has to be, for purposes of this case, an accrued or vested benefit, or it has to be said under normal principles of contract interpretation that the grievance arose under the agreement. We submit what the station told the union, what the station told Ms. Peterson, pointed that it did arise under that agreement.
Assuming that that carries some weight, they were pointing to the old agreement.
That's correct.
Well, you've just conceded that the old agreement, you can't prevail on the old agreement because the arbitration was no longer in existence. You can't have it both ways, argue that, well, look, they pointed to the agreement. Well, they're pointing to an agreement that you agree can't pass muster under Litton because arbitration is dead. Now you're trying to switch your argument to it's the new agreement. So whatever they said about reference to the old agreement is irrelevant. It doesn't get you where you want to go, right?
With respect to the court, we've argued from the beginning of this case that this grievance is arbitrable under either agreement, whether it's under the old agreement because it arose under that agreement, or it's arbitrable under the new agreement because it fell within the window period of that agreement. It's arbitrable. The Litton analysis was whether you can demonstrate that the dispute that's the subject of the grievance arose under that agreement. In this case,
under an agreement where an arbitration clause was in effect.
That's not what Litton said. What Litton said, you simply have to show whether the grievance arose under the old agreement. For example, the court cited the issue of benefits vested.
No. I think maybe we better make sure we're together on that. That is not right. Litton is talking about the availability of arbitration and whether the arbitration remedy is in effect, whether it carries forward. You may have some benefits that are vested under a prior agreement, but that doesn't mean you have the availability of arbitration if something happens during a period when the contract is expired and unless the parties have agreed that arbitration is still available.
Your Honor, I would point the court to the Nolde case, which involves severance pay. And in that case, the Supreme Court held that despite the expiration of the contract, there was no arbitration mechanism in place when the severance pay was due. The Supreme Court said, but it's a vested benefit.
Right.
And therefore, it's arbitrable, even though on the day the employees were to receive the severance pay, to use the court's analysis, there was no arbitration provision in effect. The court said it doesn't matter because it's vested. I apologize.
The company here gave her severance pay.
I'm sorry, I'm bored.
As I recall, the company here gave her severance pay, didn't it?
Yes, the company did give severance pay.
So that's a vested right. She got the money. There's no complaint about that. That still leaves the question whether the layoff was arbitrable at a time when, number one, it occurred when there wasn't a contract in effect, and number two, nothing in the original contract indicated that it would extend beyond the terms of the agreement.
And our response to that, Your Honor, is that the grievance arose under the old contract because the station repeatedly, orally, and in writing said it did. But even if you accept that it didn't arise under the old agreement, under the new agreement, the grievance was timely filed within a 20-window period that can legally reach back and capture both the January 30th letter as well as the effective date of the layoff.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I apologize.
We'll give you a minute back for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Monroe.
Good morning.
This case presents a routine, straightforward application of the Litton financial standard for the arbitrability of grievances that arise during a hiatus between collective bargaining agreements. Litton makes clear that the duty to arbitrate arises only as a matter of contract, not as a matter of statute, and therefore there is no duty to arbitrate matters during a contractual hiatus. The district court properly concluded that none of the three exceptions identified by Litton apply here, and further properly concluded that the grievance is not arbitrable under the party's new CBA because the event occurred and was complete by any rational definition before the effective date of the 2012 agreement. Therefore, as in Litton, the union's remedy was to file an unfair labor practice charge with the NLRB. It does not have an arbitration mechanism available to it here. I'll run briefly through application of each of the three Litton prongs. The first one is irrelevant. The union concedes that the conduct occurred after the 2008 agreement had expired. With respect to the second exception, accrued or vested rights, as the court has already indicated, the seniority rights at issue here were qualified, just as they were in Litton. There is a variable standard, which means that it was not fixed and ascertainable at any point after the expiration. You can't say with any certainty what Ms. Peterson's seniority rights would have been. Let me give you an example of how this would function. The agreement provision says that seniority is subordinate in any situation where the failure to retain a less senior employee would have an adverse effect on the operation of the station when all factors are considered. That standard, that all factors standard, surely encompasses the kind of aptitude and ability considerations that the Supreme Court in Litton said were variable.
It's arguably much broader than Litton.
That's correct. So the union says, well, that couldn't possibly have any effect here. It was just pay no attention to that. But in fact, if you had a situation where, for say, hypothetically, you had a bargaining unit that repairs camera equipment, and the senior member of the unit has no ability and refuses to learn how to repair digital equipment, well, then you might say if there's a reduction in force and the company has moved to all digital equipment, it might make sense to discharge the senior employee and retain the junior ones. In any event, even if the seniority rights had not been qualified, the weight of authority is clear that seniority rights are not the kind of rights that vest. Those cases are cited in our brief at page 24, footnote 11. With respect to the third Litton exception, agreements to extend, as Judge Randolph indicated, this is really addressed to situations where the parties agree that notwithstanding contractual hiatus, they will maintain some provisions of their agreement during bargaining. It's fairly common to say, well, we'll have an interim deal, we'll arbitrate grievances in exchange for a no-strike clause. They don't have any such express agreement here. There was an express agreement which expired, and the company refused to extend it any further. Now, they're pointing to this letter and the statements by the manager, but none of those statements say anything about an intent to arbitrate. None of those statements say anything about an intent to extend the agreement despite the hiatus. And weighed against that, you have the fact that there was an express extension, and that extension ended. Moreover, you have the fact that the very first time the company was asked about arbitration, it said no. That's not behavior consistent with an implied agreement to maintain the collective bargaining agreement through the hiatus. The bottom line here is that all the union is pointing to is compliance with the statutory status quo. And Litton, in cases like Pepsi Cola, which follow Litton, make it very clear that you can't have an implied agreement based on nothing more than compliance with the statutory status quo. Because there's nothing inherent about behavior consistent with compliance with legal obligations to suggest mutual assent. And that's what an implied agreement is.
Well, they're, as best I can understand, they're arguing that the new agreement came into effect, seniority rights were then restored, assuming they weren't previously vested, but they were vested in the sense that whatever I had before, I still have, which is the way it typically happens. And they're saying there's a two-week notice, which wasn't given here, and that seniority under the provisions that we're talking about says it starts out with you must lay off in order of seniority, and then there is an exception which says, which puts into play an argument that is lesser seniority employees may be laid off depending upon adverse effect, which would be a grievable and arbitrable issue. In other words, if an employer admittedly during the term of the contract lays off the way it was done here, an employee comes in and says, yeah, you didn't follow the seniority order, and the employer says, well, because a junior employee was more important to us, that would be grievable and arbitrable, right?
The problem with that analysis, with the union's analysis in this case, Your Honor, is that the act complained of was complete on January 30th.
Well, the question is, how do you put in the two-week notice?
Well, let me address that directly. If you fire me today, in circumstances where I am owed 2 weeks' notice, it is irrational to say that the discharge occurs on April 8th. Rather, what's happened is that today I've been fired, and I failed to receive my 2 weeks' notice. Right. Those are both separate events that both are complete today. It's imaginary to say that this two-week notice provision somehow extends things further when any failing by the company was complete and over and done on
January
30th.
Well, that could be a dispute. I mean, I haven't studied the agreement enough to know what I might think about that, but I can remember a lot of cases where quite the opposite was true. That is, you give the 2 weeks' notice because it allows the parties to have a cooling off period and think about whether they really want this to happen. In other words, the employee is told, in 2 weeks, this is over. And that allows the parties to grieve, to discuss, maybe do something different. Your argument, I think, is the most she's entitled to is maybe 2 additional weeks of pay, but that's it. I guess. I'm not sure what you're saying.
Well, my argument, Your Honor, is that the act, that the law identifies the date of the act as the date of notice to the employee. Now, that's true both under the Litton line of cases as well as in other contexts. For example, the Supreme Court's decision in Ricks, which addressed EEO cases, says, look, when an act occurs for purposes of statute of limitations, what you look to is the date of notice. If somebody is notified they won't receive tenure in 2012, the fact that they're retained until 2013 is irrelevant. The statute starts to run from the date of notice. Here, the date of notice to the employee and the date of the act are the same. So it doesn't matter that she claims a violation of the two-week notice provision because that violation was complete on January 30th. And the only act, as Judge Randolph indicated, the only act identified in the grievance is unjust termination on 1/30/12.
Yeah, I understand. And what they are arguing back is that, no, the two-week notice means the best you could do was to say on January 30th, in 2 weeks you're fired, that you were required to do that.
Yes, Your Honor. My argument would be, even if that had occurred, even if they had retained Ms. Peterson for the additional 2 weeks, there would still be no arbitral grievance.
Because
she was notified of the alleged violation on January 30th. And according to all of the case law, both in this context and in others, it's that date of notice that is the legally significant date. With respect to counsel's argument about the presumption of arbitrability, the Supreme Court was very clear in Litton that you have to apply the arises under test before reaching any presumption of arbitrability. And there's no distinction between the beginning of the hiatus period, in other words, a post-expiration dispute, and the end of the hiatus period, a pre-effective date dispute. The Supreme Court says, quote, the Nolde brothers' presumption is limited to disputes arising under the contract. So you have to make that arising under determination before you apply any presumption, regardless of whether you're talking about the 2008 agreement or the 2012. Unless there are any further questions, thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Paul, give you back a minute for rebuttal.
As we know, the new contract became effective on February 9th. If on February 10th, Ms. Peterson were given the same letter that the company gave her on January 30th, I don't think there's any dispute that a grievance would clearly be subject to arbitration. And whether they sent her home that day and gave her 2 weeks cash or disregarded the notice provision altogether, no matter what, that matter would be subject to arbitration, and the station's arguments that we're allowed to cash the timeout rather than give the actual notice is a matter they can raise to the arbitrator. In fact, the collective bargaining agreement, the very provision that cites the notice, the two-week advance notice, indicates that one of the purposes is in case the station would rescind that notice during that two-week period. In this case, of course, the letter was not given to Ms. Peterson on February 10th. It was given to Ms. Peterson on January 30th. But because of the 20-day grievance process period, the grievance was timely and was, under the contract, reached back to January 30th to capture that event as an alleged violation of the agreement. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Case is submitted.